happen in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. Over the last five episodes, we've been looking at the story of Roscoe Wyatt, told by his son, Ricky Wyatt. Some people, which includes at least one well-respected researcher, believes that Roscoe was the shooter on the grassy knoll that awful day in Dallas. But today I want to do something a little different. I want to look at why Ricky Wyatt believed the story of his father being the killer of JFK so deeply. First of all, Ricky grew up with a father he barely knew. Roscoe Wyatt died in 1971, when Ricky was only 10 years old. He left Ricky with a fragmented sense of who his father was, a lot of unanswered questions, and a natural desire to fill in the blanks. When someone grows up with a parent who is both absent and mysterious, it's easy for myth-taking to take root. The diaries, real or not, offered Ricky a way to explain the father he never got to understand. Ricky's family environment encouraged suspicion. Ricky's mother, Geneva Wyatt, had her own stories. She claimed she overheard Roscoe and Jack Ruby discussing the assassination. She hinted at secret government work, and she suggested Roscoe had a hidden past. Whether these stories were literal truth, misremembered events, or emotional interpretations, they shaped Ricky's worldview. He grew up in a household where the idea of Roscoe being involved in something big wasn't far-fetched. It was part of the family lore. The discovery of the documents felt like destiny when Ricky said he found diaries, photos, coded notes, and mysterious documents. It wasn't just evidence to him. It was a personal revelation. He wasn't just uncovering a conspiracy. He was uncovering his father. Even if the documents were misinterpreted, altered, or not what they appeared to be, the emotional impact on Ricky was enormous. He was surrounded by people who reinforced the story. Once Ricky shared his discoveries, he was quickly embraced by JFK conspiracy researchers, the JFK Assassination Information Center, and journalists looking for a dramatic angle. These groups didn't just listen to Ricky, they encouraged him. They helped him interpret the documents, connected dots for him, and validated his suspicions. That kind of reinforcement can make even shaky evidence seem rock solid. This story gave Ricky's father a larger-than-life identity. Instead of being a Marine, a Dallas police officer, and a man who died young in an industrial accident, Roscoe became, in Ricky's mind, a covert operative, a man with a secret past, and someone who mattered in the biggest American mystery of the century. For a son searching for meaning, that transformation is powerful. The JFK assassination is a magnet for belief. The assassination is a perfect storm of missing evidence, contradictory testimony, government secrecy, and decades of speculation. In that environment, a story like Ricky Wyatt's doesn't feel impossible. It feels plausible. And once someone starts down that path, it's hard to turn back. I, for one, know that as much as anyone, in this case after 37 years of research. Another thing is Ricky wanted to believe this story. This is the emotional core. Ricky wasn't trying to deceive anyone. Most investigators who met him described him as sincere, even earnest. He wanted answers, a connection, a sense of identity, and a way to make sense of a father who left too soon. The diaries, whatever their origin, gave him all of that. Ricky Wyatt believed the story because it filled emotional, psychological, and narrative gaps in his life. It wasn't just a conspiracy theory to him. It was a way to understand his father, his family, and himself. But Ricky Wyatt's story unraveled over time. Early enthusiasm turned into scrutiny. When Ricky held his 1990 press conference, the JFK research community was electrified. a Dallas police officer's son claiming his father was part of a CIA hit team? It sounded like the breakthrough people had been waiting for years. But once the initial excitement faded, researchers began asking basic questions. Where did the documents come from? Why were there no originals? Why did the handwriting not match known sample? The more people looked, the more inconsistencies they found. The diaries failed authentication tests. Multiple investigators, journalists, handwriting experts, and JFK researchers examined the supposed diaries and documents. This is what they found. No verifiable chain of custody, no consistent handwriting, no corroborating evidence from any agency or archive. Some documents appeared to be typed on machines not available during the period they supposedly came from. This was the first major crack. Also, Ricky's timeline didn't match known facts. As researchers compared Ricky's claims to Roscoe White's Marine records, Dallas Police Department employee files, and known movements of CIA personnel, it became clear that many of the events Ricky described simply could not have happened when or how he said they did. For example, Roscoe's Dallas Police Department employment dates didn't align with the alleged covert missions. His Marine service didn't overlap with the CIA training Ricky described, and no evidence placed Roscoe in the locations the diaries claimed. These contradictions were impossible to reconcile. And then the JFK Assassination Information Center started backing away. The group that initially supported Ricky, hoping he had uncovered something explosive, eventually distanced itself. They realized the documents were unreliable, and Ricky's story changed over time, and key claims couldn't be verified. When even the people who championed the story stepped back, it signaled that the foundation was crumbling. Ricky's own statements became inconsistent. As reporters and researchers pressed him with questions, Ricky's story began to shift. Dates changed, details were added or removed, explanations became more hypothetical. This wasn't malicious. Most observers believe Ricky was sincere, but it made the narrative increasingly unstable. Investigators found no evidence of CIA links. No intelligence agency, CIA, FBI, or military found any record of Roscoe White being recruited, a Mandarin code name, a three-man hit team, or orders to kill JFK or Officer J.D. Tippit. The absence of any supporting documentation was a major blow, so the story quietly faded. By the mid-1990s, the diaries were widely considered inauthentic. The narrative was viewed as a well-intentioned but misguided family myth. Ricky withdrew from public attention. The story didn't end with a dramatic debunking. It simply lost credibility until it no longer held weight in serious JFK research circles. Most people who interacted with Ricky came away with the same impression. He wasn't trying to deceive anyone. He was a man trying to understand a father he barely knew. And the documents, whatever their origin, gave him a story that felt meaningful. The tragedy is that the emotional truth for Ricky didn't match the historical truth. Now let's look at verified facts versus Ricky White's claims. First, let's look at Roscoe White's military service. Verified facts are he served in the U.S. Marine Corps, stationed in Japan, Okatsuki, in 1957. There's no evidence of CIA training. Ricky's claim is Roscoe was recruited into covert CIA operations during his Marine Corps service and given the codename Mandarin. So what about the connection to Lee Harvey Oswald? The verified facts are that no documented interaction between Roscoe White and Lee Harvey Oswald, despite both serving as a Pan Okatsuki at different times. Now Ricky claims that Roscoe and Oswald allegedly knew each other and were part of the same covert program. So what about Roscoe's employment with the Dallas Police Department? The verified facts are that Roscoe White joined the Dallas Police Department in September 1963, 2 months before JFK's assassination. No disciplinary or suspicious records exist. Ricky claims that Roscoe joined the Dallas Police Department as part of a CIA plan to position him for the assassination of John Kennedy. As far as Roscoe's role on November 22, 1963, the verified facts are that no evidence placing Roscoe anywhere except normal police duties exist. No witnesses or record ties him to Dealey Plaza as a shooter. Ricky claims Roscoe was one of three shooters firing from the grassy knoll as part of a CIA hit team. Then there's the killing of Officer J.D. Tippit. The verified facts are no evidence links Roscoe to Tippit's murder. As we all know, Lee Harvey Oswald was charged for the killing, even though in my opinion, he was not the killer, but neither was Roscoe Wyatt. Now Ricky claims that Roscoe allegedly killed Tippit under CIA orders to silence him. Here's a biggie, what about the diaries? No authentication diaries exist. Documents presented in 1990 were inconsistent and failed verification. Now Ricky claims Roscoe kept secret diaries detailing CIA missions, including orders to kill JFK and Officer J.D. Tippit. So what about the Jack Ruby connection with the Wyatts? The verified facts are Geneva Wyatt, Roscoe's wife, briefly worked for Jack Ruby, but no evidence shows Roscoe had any relationship with Ruby. Ricky claims that Geneva overheard Roscoe and Ruby discussing the assassination. So what about Roscoe's employment after he left the Dallas Police Department? The verified facts are he worked for M&M Equipment until his death in 1971. There's no evidence of covert activity. But Ricky claims Roscoe continued CIA operations after the assassination. As far as Roscoe's death, the verified facts are that he died in an industrial accident in 1971 after a workplace fire. But Ricky suggested Roscoe's death was suspicious or tied to keeping him quiet and silencing him. So what all these comparisons shows that I just listed is when you lay two narratives side by side, a pattern emerges. Ricky's claims rely on documents that were never authenticated. Verified records contradict key parts of the story, especially timelines. No independent evidence supports CIA involvement, code names, or a three-shooter team. Roscoe's life, as documented, was ordinary, not covert or clandestine. Ricky's version is dramatic and emotionally compelling, but it doesn't align with the historical record. While there are intriguing overlaps between Roscoe Wyatt and Lee Harvey Oswald, such as their service at the CIA-linked Uxugi Air Base, employment with the Dallas Police Department, Wyatt's wife allegedly working at Jack Ruby's club, and both men having reported ties to military intelligence, it's important to note that the core of the Roscoe Wyatt story is based on a missing diary and unverified claims made by members of Wyatt's family. These claims lack independent cooperation or authenticated documentation. While some elements raise interesting questions, the theory has not been supported by concrete, verifiable evidence and is not accepted as factual by the mainstream historical or investigative community. Roscoe Wyatt's story fits a lot of the pieces of who we are looking for behind the grassy knoll. The two pieces it does not fit in my mind is, one, a contract killer. In my opinion and in my research, this was a coup d'etat, not an assassination. Kennedy wasn't killed out of personal disdain. He was killed because his policies were taking the country in another and a much more enlightened direction. The Warren Commission defender stance that whoever killed Kennedy would have talked by now is normally one I dismiss, because people have talked. But there is a massive difference between E. Howard Hunt, a legitimate CIA spook, and Roscoe Wyatt's kid finding a diary that is now conveniently with the FBI are missing. Whoever the second shooter was, I absolutely need to know how they got Secret Service credentials. I believe that Officer Smith confronted the real killer that day on the grassy knoll. The Secret Service man who showed his credentials to the officer was, in my final opinion, the shooter, not a decoy, but the real deal. Without this detail, I just can't go there. Next episode, we start looking at another man who claimed to be the shooter on the grassy knoll. We begin our breakdown of Mr. James Files. We'll see you next time. Those of you that have not purchased my book yet and would like to learn more about the assassination, drop me an email at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com and I will get you a personalized signed copy in the mail. It would make a great gift for anyone interested in the JFK assassination. It is an oversized coffee table style book that is over 500 pages and contains hundreds of pictures, most of them in vibrant color. I can promise you will not be disappointed in a book. The price is $60 for the hardcover and $40 for the softcover. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com.